Excuse me, I'm just gonna chug this cold hot toddy.
All right. Hello, and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast brought to you by the phenomenally young, fairly hip, and technically lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Olga Segura.
Hey, guys.
And Zach Davis.
Is there a reason we didn't say often over brews?
Because that would be just...
Yeah.
It rhymes.
I know.
All right. Okay. So I guess there was a reason. I'm sure that's not the first time I thought that.
It's a terrible idea, Zach.
Okay.
Speaking of brews...
We are drinking today.
It's not a brew, is it?
No. But today we're drinking hot toddies because it's the doldrums. Today's the last day of January.
And oh, thank God.
We're about to end the second worst month of the year and roll into the worst month of the year when it's cold and we have nothing to look forward to.
Except Valentine's Day.
And and February struck back with a holiday of its own to supersede.
Well, also, guys, I'm excited to be officially drinking starting tomorrow. So I'm looking forward to
Yes, we will be happy to get to include you in our toasts.
Yes,
But until then, me and Zach
I'll just
will.
Have the toddy.
Coffee mug cheer.
Is it just a toddy without the alcohol? Or is,
No.
Okay,
coffee,
sorry.
Coffee is not a toddy.
I was just going to pretend that it's a toddy. But anyways.
Who are we talking to this week, Olga?
Today we're talking with Jordan Zanari Duffner. She's an associate at the Bridge Initiative, where she studies Muslim-Christian relationships and Islamophobia. And she is the author of Finding Jesus Among Muslims, How Loving Islam Makes Me a Better Catholic. So we're going to be talking to her about her book and the work she does. Also, we're giving away two of her books if you leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. So listeners.
It's a great book. And so if you've been holding out, you're like, man, I'm really lazy. I don't want to do it because it is really easy to do.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now's your time.
Yeah. So if you want a copy of Jordan's book, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and send us an email to let us know that you actually left us a review.
Yes.
At jesuitical@americamedia.org.
Thank you. Yes. I forgot what our email was.
It's a difficult one. But before we get to that, we have...
What do we have?
Signs of the Times.
Oh, yeah. I thought you had a surprise for me.
No surprises.
Yes, it is time for Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. What's our first story, Zach?
So we're recording on Wednesday, which means it is the day after the State of the Union address by President Trump, which was Tuesday night. Did you guys watch?
I did.
I did not.
It got in the way of my Game of Thrones catching up,
which
was very upsetting. It was an hour and 20 minutes.
Yeah, wow. And it didn't start until 9.
The average length is like an hour.
We're bringing this up on Jesuitical because an undocumented medical student from Loyola Stritch School of Medicine in Chicago, this is my alma mater, Cesar Montelongo was Senator Dick Durbin's guest to the State of the Union. You know, there's a trend of people who are attending the State of the Union, they get guests to use their guests to sort of make political statements.
And this young man is a dreamer. So part of Trump's speech was talking about the dreamers and the DACA deal. But he also talked about other dreamers in a kind of, divisive way, I would say.
Yeah, he made that comment like, Americans are dreamers too, which is so othering. Like, I'm going to acknowledge your existence, that you're a dreamer, but also you are not part of this group, which is Americans, even though, you know, these people like Cesar are very much American.
Right. And that was something that Senator Durbin was hoping to accomplish. He wanted to remind President Trump that these dreamers are people who want to give more to this country. They've been here and they are not just people who have no skills. Like he's in med school and he's contributing to society and wants to contribute to a society that he's also a part of.
Yes. And this isn't the only news out of Chicago regarding dreamers and sticking up for DACA recipients. Father Gary Graff, who is a priest in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago at St. Procopius, is going on a hunger strike in support of local dreamers. And so God willing, Father Graff is not going to eat anything except for water and protein powder until the March 5th deadline. That's when the Congress has to pass something before they become deportable. But it's interesting in the sense that he's using fasting as a sort of political protest, which has a long tradition in the Catholic Church, right?
Yeah, it does. It was, you know, it's a pretty contemporary thing. It's not something we see like in the Middle Ages, more like 19th century onward, but most famously during the Troubles in Ireland. It was a tactic used by members of the IRA against the British crown. So hunger striking is not exactly uncontroversial in the Catholic Church, especially if you go into it intending to not eat until you potentially die. That could be considered, you know, intentionally taking your life, which is seen as a grave sin. So Father Grath said, I'm not an advocate of intentional suicide. I'm not going to let this take my life away or bring me to the point where I literally end up hospitalized. So he's not going for that. Mm-hmm. But then that kind of takes, does that take the teeth out of?
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I mean, no one has a good existence on protein powder and water.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So you being willing to offer up your suffering, because that's, I would say it's definitely suffering, for a cause, is a very mystical Catholic idea. It also has political dimensions, which is sort of the church and the world really colliding.
The Catholic both and.
Yeah, totally.
Okay. What's next, Olga?
So this is just a quick update to our SOT from last week, where we discuss Pope Francis's latest handling of sexual abuse allegations in, and these are coming out of Chile. He's actually going to be sending Archbishop Charles Scicluna to listen to victims and kind of investigate all of these allegations that are coming out of Chile. This is a pretty big deal because this archbishop was the chief prosecutor at the height of the sexual abuse crisis breaking in the United States. And he's very well known and very well respected among victims. So this is seen as a pretty positive step from Pope Francis.
So if you didn't hear last week, Pope Francis came under a lot of fire for defending this bishop in Chile who victims have accused of covering up the crimes of this notorious priest abuser. So it sounds like he's taken that criticism to heart
is
taking pretty decisive action. So we'll see what happens.
So what's next, Ashley?
Happier news. A couple in Uxbridge, Massachusetts, Edward and Lena Gowan, renewed their wedding vows after 70 years of marriage. When they first got married, he was Catholic, she was a Congregationalist, and they couldn't get married in the church. So this was pre-Vatican II, and I don't know exactly.
Who knows what happened in the church before that?
Yeah, but they got married in a church rectory.
Okay,
so I think they had a sacramental wedding, but it wasn't in the church. And as we also discussed last week, people like getting married in churches. Whether they like having an official Catholic wedding, whether it's on an airplane or in your childhood church, which is what they did. Mr. Gowan is 90, Mrs. Gowan is 89, and they had all of their children and grandchildren and great grandchildren.
And the family organized it for them,
So they had their wedding ceremony, and they were asked, you know, some advice about how you have a good marriage after 70 years. And
what do they know?
It's only 70 years.
Mr. Gowan said, "I don't go out the door without giving her a kiss." Very good advice. They don't fight about religion because, you know, they're both Christians, but he's Catholic. She's Congregationalist. And she often jokes that sometimes she just doesn't wear her hearing aid. So, yes, great wisdom from our elders. What's next, Zach?
So our next story comes from Canada, where the severed arm of St. Francis Xavier is making its way across Canada.
Oh, God.
So is this like a tour? a relic tour?
It is. And it actually started towards the end of last year. So the arm of right forearm of St. Francis Xavier, which is, you know, the arm he used to baptize lots of people with. This is why it's sort of venerated. It's seen better days, certainly. If you look up a picture of it.
I thought it like hadn't deteriorated at all. It's a miracle.
Sometimes we're like, Catholics are like, oh, look at the saint's body. It's incorruptible. And you're like,
my arm is like that.
It's like, he should have seen a doctor way sooner. That's probably what killed him. No, but it doesn't look like it's 500 years old also. But it is making its way through Canada, and it actually has its own seat on Air Canada flights.
Oh, wow.
And there's this person, Angela Rainier, who's been tasked with traveling with it, and she's been given a special duffel bag to carry the arm in that's got a lot of padding and protection.
Oh, wow.
And she said, it's like doing a road trip with a friend.
Do you think it smells?
No, I think it's got a like encased thing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's weird. It's super weird.
No, but also appropriate because I've heard St. Francis Xavier been called the first global saint? Because his whole thing was like, he was one of St. Ignatius Loyola's first companions. And like, as soon as he was in the Jesuits, he was out traveling in India, trying to go to China. So
yeah,
he might not have made it to China, but
if only
now
he's
in
have.
Canada.
Now he's in Canada, flying maybe first class. Don't know. All right. What's our next story?
Going to Ireland now, where
across the world.
Where a Catholic priest is warning that there has been an exponential increase in demonic activity, and he's calling on the bishop to provide more exorcists or priests who are trained exorcists. So he said in recent years, he's a trained exorcist, and he's been getting a lot of requests from people worried about demonic possession.
So is there a reason for the rise in demonic activity, or?
Unclear. I'm guessing it's social media, because that's
that explains it. That explains it. Or millennials.
Yeah. But I just thought it's been a while since we've talked about the demons.
That is a good point.
I just wanted to get your reactions to this.
Well, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, sometimes you might think like, wow, I wonder if the news is extra negative. Then there are actual literal demons going around the world, and maybe things are getting worse.
Yeah, and actually, this is not just one Irish priest. The International Association of Exorcists, there is a thing, 400 Catholic leaders, and they have seen a dramatic increase in demonic activity in recent years.
So
it's not just Ireland.
Yeah, yikes. But just pray to Mama Mary. Pope Francis recently said that demons don't come in if she's in the house, so say a couple Hail Marys.
Joining us today via Skype is Jordan Denari Duffner. She studies Muslim-Christian relations and Islamophobia and is the author of Finding Jesus Among Muslims, How Loving Islam Makes Me a Better Catholic. Welcome to Jesuitical, Jordan.
Thank you, guys.
So, based on the research, what do Catholics think they know about Islam and what are they getting wrong?
Well, Catholics know some basic things about Muslims, that they pray often and that they fast, but they're less familiar with a lot of the things that Catholics and Muslims share in terms of theology and religious figures and things like that. A lot of Catholics don't know that figures like Mary and Jesus are really important in the Islamic tradition. They're, as I mentioned, they're familiar with fasting and prayer, but they don't realize that, you know, giving to the poor and those sorts of more social justice oriented things are also really important to Muslims.
And do Catholics know in general, do they know other Muslims in their own personal lives?
Well, one of the things that I was surprised to find in some of the research that I did with the Bridge Initiative on Catholics' views of Muslims and their relationships with Muslims is that Catholics were actually less likely than the general American public to know somebody who is Muslim personally. And that really surprised me because, you know, Catholics are really diverse. We're all over the country, and I would have thought that we would be like the rest of Americans and have a similar level of familiarity, but only about 3 in 10 Catholics know someone who is Muslim personally, and that kind of surprised me.
And when did you start, when did you first meet someone who was Muslim, and what were those first interactions like?
Well, the first Muslim that I knew well was a student at my Jesuit high school in Indianapolis, where I went. And his name was Nader. And I talk about him a lot in the book, actually. And he was, you know, an ordinary high school student like myself. He was also a fellow Hoosier. So we were both really into basketball. And so that was a commonality. But I was really struck by his dedication to serving the poor, and He really wanted to be a medical doctor and serve people in that way. And he's now actually in med school, which is really cool, and making that dream come true.
And can you talk a little bit more about the misconceptions that Americans have about Muslims?
Yeah, well, I think we all are very aware that there's the stereotype of Muslims being violent or Islam promoting violence. One of the common tropes that comes up too is that our religions or our religious communities are pitted against each other. But these things don't really mesh with reality once you actually get to know people and see Islam and see Muslims behind the headlines. A lot of people asked me when I came back from the Middle East, like, oh, were you as a Christian welcome there, or did you feel uncomfortable there? And I felt so embraced there, and that my Christianity was embraced, and that just my life as a religious person was valued, and I was able to strengthen in my and grow and be strengthened in my faith when I was there. One of the things I'm constantly in awe of is the dedication to prayer that my Muslim friends have. I encountered that in college when I lived in a living learning community for Muslim students on campus at Georgetown. And my roommate would get up early in the morning and, you know, stop throughout her day to pray. And I thought, man, that's dedication. I want to be like that. I wish I had that. And so that's one of the ways that I've been enriched in my relationship with God.
And what have you learned in your own personal and professional experience about what does it mean to be an ally to Muslim people, and, you know, combating some of these stereotypes and standing with them in Islamophobic structures and situations?
When we encounter problematic comments or prejudicial comments that people make in our communities, we need to approach them about those things. Obviously, we can do that in a kind way, but I think we owe it to our Muslim brothers and sisters to stand up for them in our own communities, particularly if we're in a Catholic or religious context. When I was in high school, I received an email from a very close family friend, and it was one of those chain emails that's hateful that people send around.
Yeah.
And it was an anti-Muslim message, and it was sent by a very close family friend of ours. And it really struck me. It was it really troubled me. I thought, you know, this is someone who is really close to me, who, you know, sees her faith as a source of goodness in the world, and yet she's sending this around to other people in our Catholic community, and she's effectively equating with what the message was, equating all Muslims with terrorists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, you know, I didn't know a lot of Muslims at the time. I knew this kid Nader from school, but it really just didn't sit well with me. And I was talking to my parents about it, and my mom took me by the shoulders and she said, you know, Jordan, that's why you have to write. It's mm-hmm. it's this mm-hmm. sort of thing that you need to help address in our community. And it was really a vocational moment for me. And it's ultimately the reason why I wrote this book. It's the reason why I do what I do. I've had such positive experiences myself in the Muslim community, and I want my fellow Catholics to be able to move past some of the prejudice and the misconceptions that they have.
Well, yeah. I think that's something a lot of people can relate to, whether that's like a chain email or a mm-hmm. Facebook post.
Yeah.
Or having to like have uncomfortable conversations with family and friends about politics in this day and age too.
Yeah. But your advice to people who might also share that experience is write a book.
No, you don't have to do that, but there's things that each of us can do. And like you were saying, it's about having those sometimes more difficult conversations with people. But I think we can do it in a way that's charitable and faith-filled. And one of the things that I would say to Catholics who want to do more in this regard is we have so many resources, you know, from our Catholic tradition that can inspire us and that we can utilize in this work of combating Islamophobia, whether it's Nostra Aetate, which is the Vatican II document that talks about the church's relationship to other religions.
I actually thought that was mostly about Judaism, but it's not solely about Judaism, right?
Right. So one of the initial documents or an earlier version of the document was going to solely be focused on Judaism, but they ended up opening it up and writing about different religious traditions, including Islam. There's an entire paragraph on Muslims and the things that Muslims share with Catholics and the things that we should praise as Catholics about Muslims and their religion. And the first line of that is, the Catholic Church holds Muslims in high regard. And I just wish more Catholics knew that our default attitude towards Muslims is one of esteem and admiration and respect and an acknowledgement of all the similarities that we have.
I think That's obviously true. But like you said, a lot of Catholics might not have read that document and might not know Muslims and might be worried about entering into dialogue because they are afraid of saying the wrong thing or causing offense. So what kind of like road rules for interfaith dialogue would you lay out for people if they want to get involved in this?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that dialogue isn't only about sitting down and having a formal conversation about religion with people. And that's one of the cool things about what the church has taught about dialogue is that there's all these different forms of dialogue. And one of those forms is the dialogue of life, which is more informal. It's when we're living side by side with people and sharing our joys and sorrows. So the first thing I would say to a lot of Catholics who might be skeptical is you might already be dialoguing and not even realize it. So that's the first thing. You know, as Pope Francis says, whenever we approach another with openness and love, I'm paraphrasing, but with openness and love and a desire to learn about the other, that's dialogue. Yeah. Obviously willing to share of ourselves as well, but also to receive from them.
Yeah, and in your book, you make the distinction between dialogue and proclamation, or what other people might call evangelization. So generally speaking, would you say you go into dialogue not really trying to change each other's mind?
Yes.
Or converting someone? Is that unhelpful?
Right. It's the worst way to hang out with someone, actually. Yeah, God.
I know better than you, and I'm here to tell you why.
I want to be friends with that person.
But so is there room for both?
Well, in the church's mission broadly, there is room for both. You know, evangelization, broadly understood, incorporates both dialogue and proclamation. I do think, though, that there is a type of conversion that does happen in dialogue, and that might not necessarily mean anyone's changing their religious, you know, affiliation, but we're hopefully always being called to turn towards God, to be converted towards God and by one another.
Is there a danger in kind of in this, you know, admirable desire for unity and relationship of flattening out differences too much in a way that doesn't really respect either tradition?
Sounds like you think the answer is yes, Ashley.
No, so I think it's important to be able to like hold these disagreements and differences, you know, even as we enter relationship, but that seems like a hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, Christians have the Trinity and Muslims don't. Obviously, that's an obvious difference, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that the values that we have are different. I think it is important to explain other religions on their own terms, or allow other religious communities to explain their religious traditions on their own terms. For example, one of our most beloved saints is Saint Francis of Assisi. And a lot of people don't know that.
Careful, this is a Jesuit podcast.
I know. I still love Ignatius. Saint Francis as well. A lot of people don't know that he, during the Crusades, actually spent a number of days with the Muslim Sultan in Egypt. And it's not really clear what everything that happened in that encounter, but it was an experience of dialogue that did shape Saint Francis's life and the way he lived out his Franciscan charism. And there's some Franciscan scholars who will argue that the reason why certain things were recommended for the Franciscans were shaped by Francis's encounter with Islam and Muslims, which is really cool. There's a book by Paul Moses called The Saint and the Sultan that I would highly recommend that talks about this. There's a few documentaries out about this right now too. So it's a really interesting story about Saint Francis. And yeah, so I think there's so many things that we can call upon within our Catholic faith that are reminders that this is not something new, and this is something that we're all called to.
Yeah. So speaking of saints, our last question, you might see this coming. If you could canonize one person, living or dead, Catholic or Muslim or any other faith, who would it be and why?
So I initially thought that I was going to canonize Father Christian de Chargey, who was a French monk who lived in Algeria in the 90s. And for me, he is a real example of what it means to be a Catholic in dialogue with Muslims. And I write about him a lot in my book. But I found out recently that he is actually already on the path.
He's on the way.
Yes. He and his brother monks are already on the path to canonization. So I'm actually going to canonize Father Christian's friend, Muhammad. And it's a long story, but there was a situation in which Muhammad ended up saving Christian's life and in the process losing his own life. And this was a really pivotal and moving moment in Father Christian's life and in his vocation. And he writes about how, you know, in the Eucharist, he realized that it wasn't only, you know, Jesus whose sacrifice was present there, but also that of his friend Muhammad. And so Father Christian was convinced that Muhammad was in heaven, that he was a saint. And as I write in the book, I think the communion of saints is full of Muslims. And so Muhammad is just one of those people.
All right.
That's great.
Okay.
Thank you so much for joining us, Jordan. And where can people find your book?
They can find it through Liturgical Press or on Amazon. And I also have a little website associated with the book as well, which is just findingjesusamongmuslims.com.
And listeners, we are going to be giving away two of these books if you leave us a review on iTunes.
We should say that's courtesy of Jordan, so thank you.
I will happily send them along to you if you review Jesuitical, which is a great show.
Thanks. But you have to say that
I'm
now.
I'm an avid listener.
Oh, thank you.
I've listened to every episode.
Oh, we love hearing that.
Ashley hasn't even listened to every episode.
That is true.
Oh, my goodness. Jordan, right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Yeah,
bye.
You too.
Bye.
All right, now it's time for some listener feedback. So last episode, we asked you what you thought about Pope Francis's handling of sex abuse in the church. And we got really thoughtful responses. One from Stephanie Carlton, who talked about she was on her way out of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And then Pope Francis was elected and, she, you know, he brought her back in. And she's really dismayed by how he's handled this. Mm-hmm. So hopefully the update we gave this week gives her some hope that he's going to learn from his mistakes.
And Jesuit brother Dan from Canada wrote in and saying, in the context of, you know, he's really thankful for everything that Pope Francis has done. He feels like he's done a lot of good for the church and opening it up to people who are normally have sort of not considered the faith before. But all that considered, he was embarrassed and hurt by his comments. But also he's struggling to deal with, you know, recognizing the Pope is human. Like all of us. And so trying to hold that intention with the admiration that he has is, I think, something we can all relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed. And exciting news, guys. We've got the two winners. Last week, we were giving away two spots to Bobby Carly's Ignatian Yoga Retreat that's happening this weekend. And the winners are Justin True and his wife, Rachel Marie. So congrats, guys.
Oh, congrats. Mm-hmm. Have a very relaxing and Ignatian.
Spiritually enriching.
Yes.
And stretchy retreat.
And just a reminder to our listeners that if they want to be entered to possibly win our next book giveaway, they got to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and email us to let us know that they left a review. And you can win a copy of Jordan's book, Finding Jesus Among Muslims.
All right. Now it's time for Consolations and Desolations, the part of our show where we talk about where we found God this week and where it was harder to find God. Olga, what do you have?
I've got a desolation this week. So my boyfriend and I have started these premarital counseling classes at our parish.
Can I freak out for a second?
You can.
Like a big deal.
You can. You can totally freak out. But yes, Ashley, sorry to drop this on you. It's my favorite thing. We have started these premarital classes because we're talking about getting engaged this year. So we went to our first one this past Sunday, and I went in with a really open mind, and I was super excited about this. And the couple who does it, they've been married for, I think, 10, 15 years. And we sit down and we're like 10 minutes in, and then it gets really problematic. She starts telling me, you know, women are the weaker sex, direct quote, and that a lot of the issues that exist in society, it's because women are striving for too much and like men just have to be the leaders and we have to follow. And that was just really just like extremely desolating for me because this is a community that I've been a part of for almost a year. And Enoch and I have established ourselves there. We were building this community together, and just kind of being met with this bad theology has sort of made me question whether or not I still want to be a part of this. And it's just really kind of turning me away from these people who have helped me grow spiritually. I really enjoyed this congregation, and just, it's just really disheartening to let this one class push me away from God in this space that I've created, that we've created, you know?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah, I know. It's rough. But I was like, at least I got a desolation for this week. So silver lining.
Oh my God. I don't know. There's this weird gamifying that's happening to our spiritual lives, I feel like.
Oh,
where
I know.
Something bad happens to us, or and then we're like, oh, sweet. Check that button. Know what I'm going to talk about this week on the show?
My consolation this week is that I have a desolation to bring to Eric.
Okay.
But no, really, I have a desolation.
Okay.
I did watch the State of the Union last night. And the part that really struck me was that President Trump used these two parents whose daughters had been murdered by members of MS-13 to score political points. And, you know, Trump has said a lot of terrible things, but this struck me really in a new way because I had recently lost a loved one to murder, and the idea of using that pain and the fear, like, you know, I know the fear and pain that comes with that, and to see it used in that way for a political agenda was really, really desolating. What do you have, Zach?
So I have a consolation this week. One of the things I had to do at work this week was go through America's archives looking for a Lenten article that we're going to put in our print issue. And it sort of struck me, one, because Lent is around the corner. But as looking through these things, I realized that like Lent's coming up, and it filled me with the sense of excitement or anticipation that I'm going to reexamine my relationship to God in this new way. So something is coming, and change is going to come with that, and it's going to be good or bad, or I don't know, but sort of feeling like I'm going to be re-engaged in a new way in my prayer life has been really consoling this week. Not that it's happened yet, but I guess maybe it sort of has.
Yeah. Give me a prayer life, but not yet.
Yeah. Or it's the start of something new.
Oh, God. Okay.
Do you really just choose this consolation so you can sing High purpose. School Musical?
No comment.
All right.
On that note,
Jesuitical is brought to you by America Media and produced by Eloise Blondio. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Jesuit formation provided by Eric Sundrup, SJ. Engineering by Angelo Jesus Conta. Adverbs provided by friend of the show, Robert Christian. Our logo is by Sean Tripoli. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show. And please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can win a book by our guest, Jordan Denary Duffner. And shout out this week to Claire Bear ND, who did leave us a review. So thank you, Claire Bear. And send us your questions, feedback, cocktail recipes, and tell us where you found God this week at Jesuitical.
Sorry.
At jesuitical@americamedia.org. For America Media.
Almost there. Finish. Finish.
I'm Ashley McKinless with Olga Segura and Zach Davis. We will see you next week.
Ah!